Do I identify myself?
I'll introduce you.
Okay, go for it.
Today is Wednesday, October 17th, 2012. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. And today I'm interviewing Connie Latsko about her experiences in the 1968 U.S. Olympic Games. Connie, can you begin with your birth name and when and where you were born?
Yes, of course. My birth name was Constance Benton, B-E-N-T-O-N. I was born in New York City in 1927, which makes me not a kid.
Not a kid. That's why we don't want to talk to too many kids in this project. So, where did you grow up? Did you grow up in New York?
I have lived in New York area all my life.
Okay.
I went to school in New York City, graduated from high school, graduated from professional school, worked in various banks in New York, Wall Street included, for 6 years, and then I married and moved to Texas, where Bill Latsko was stationed in the United States Army.
Ha. Huh. Where in Texas was that?
We lived in Texas for 6 months when he was serving in the United States Army in the Guided Missiles Battalion, where they were doing advanced research on what became the space program.
Mm.
So we were pioneers way back then.
And so were you living near Houston or San Antonio?
We were living in El Paso.
Oh.
On the Army post, Fort Bliss, which was an interesting experience. It's right by the Rio Grande, which is across the border from Mexico. So came from New York City, a city of high-rises, apartments, and high, tall business buildings. Moved to Texas, moved to El Paso, which is a city of two-story high buildings. I suffered culture shock for a while. In addition to which, it was a English and Spanish-speaking environment. And 60 years ago, the language problem in New York was not as solvable as it is now. Many people in New York are bilingual. I've trained myself to be semi-bilingual in Spanish, too. So it was a broadening experience going from New York City to El Paso, Texas.
Mm. I'm sure that must have been a culture shock. Well,
we managed to cope because, as you probably indicated from Dr. Latsko, he had transferred himself from Europe to the United States when he was a child. So one accommodates and acclimates as one needs to.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you first become involved in fencing?
The short story is that after I graduated and finished my business training, I started going to college at night, taking courses. And I alternated a brain course and a brawn course. So I took tennis lessons, modern dancing lessons, economic lessons, accounting lessons, et cetera, because I have a natural curiosity for many things, but I'm also athletically inclined. And I found the atmosphere among fencers very pleasant. The fencers are extremely nice people, generally quite intelligent, because most of them start in college, although these days the kids start sooner. But it was an atmosphere that appealed to me, and I made many friends and eventually met a super friend whom I married.
So tell me about meeting Bill through fencing, or Dr. Latsko through fencing.
Well, the club environment in fencing after the college age is passed is very conducive to socializing and interaction with various sports events and social events. And that's where I met who became Dr. Latsko. And then I became Mrs. Latsko.
And what year was that?
1951.
Okay. And so tell me a little bit more about how you and Dr. Latsko got involved or more involved with fencing and the national team and with the Olympic team.
Okay. Bill Latsko went to Korea in 1952, and Mrs. Latsko stayed home and had a baby. Of course, there had been communication between us in the meantime, so we had baby. And when he came home, it was apparent that the baby was not normal. And we spent many years and harrowing experiences living with a baby who was physically and mentally impaired. She lived for 5.5 years, and she died. In the meantime, the fencing organization was at a crossroads of anxiety. They needed somebody to do clerical work. They didn't have much money to pay them. They had no office. They had no facilities. And I needed something to do because having care of a basket case baby, you need some kind of mental stimulation. So I said I would volunteer. I volunteered to become the secretary, using my living room as a office and my skill as a secretary and a financially trained ex-banking type person. And they loved it. So for the next 30 years, I was maid of all work in every capacity they needed to have done. And I grew from starting with taking care of the paperwork, taking care of the registration, taking care of the money. Pretty soon we were taking care of the fences when they went traveling. And after the child died, in order to pay something back to the community who had supported us with much moral support and some physical support, we decided to teach fencing to the local high school kids. So that was another outlet for us to be involved with fencing, because each of us was a fencer. And the kids loved it. The town loved it. This was the beginning of child juvenile delinquency problems. So any activity you give a kid helps them use up their energy, among other things. And we became pretty well known among the lower club circuit. We took the kids, the town loaned us a bus, and we took the kids to various clubs and schools for competitions, et cetera, et cetera. And little by little, it grew and grew. And I became the lady mayor, you know, quote and unquote, of the town because everybody knew me. I was the fencing lady. Now, in a small town in New Jersey, this is quite glamorous, you see. Even though we were living on the bank of the Hudson River, across the river from Manhattan. Have you ever been to Manhattan?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, picture living on the edge of looking out over the Atlantic Ocean, but another city across the way. Anyway, that was the neighborhood. So we had this large collection of kids, sometimes 50 or 60 of them, and we were locally known, as I said, as the fencing lady. And it was a lot of fun. I had two more children in the interim, so here I am with my two children and a bag of weapons riding around various places. And you see, when you have a fencing club, you have to take care of the swords, the masks, the jackets, the water bottles, et cetera, et cetera. So I got pretty good at it. Not being a Girl Scout or inclined to be a Girl Scout, I was the fencing lady with all that it entailed. One of the women in the neighborhood was really helpful when I needed help with enrolling members for the USFA. We started out with about 600 members in 1951. This was somewhat after the war, but there was not a big movement for fencing in the United States. And 600 members was respectable. Much of it centered around New York City, some Chicago, some California, one in Texas that I recall, and scatterings around the country. When we were in the Army, we traveled with a bag of weapons and found places to fence and taught kids to fence. One of our uniquenesses was to run a fencing meet in El Paso on the Army post in 1951. Can I tell him about that? Okay, here's a cutie. Among the people who were involved with the space program in El Paso were many highly trained specialists in electronics, in electricity, in physics, etc., etc. And one of the interesting parts of fencing is that it was being converted to being scored electronically. I'm sure you watched where you see the lights go on. I hope you did anyway. Mm-hmm. And somebody yells, "I won," because the light went on. Mm-hmm. But the machine is very complicated. So Dr. Latsko enlisted a couple of privates to help him create a machine with relays and timings and cutouts, and I'm not sure how complicated. Anyway, these two fellows turned out to be PhD physicists from MIT. They were doing their military service. So he said, "I can get you each a weekend pass if you can construct the machine with these capabilities." So they went out and took the V2 rockets apart, and they did this, that, and the other thing, and came up with a very functional electronic scoring machine to run a fencing competition. I hope you're getting all this because it's pretty unique.
Yes.
Anyway, beg pardon?
Yes, it is very unique, very interesting.
So we went to the commanding officer and we said we'd like to run a fencing competition. The people that we had taught on the Army post, because we were teaching them, we had a class, and the local fencing club with whom we were very friendly. So we had a fencing meet on the Army post one Saturday afternoon, and a lot of soldiers and their wives and so forth came. And it was very successful. It was written up in the local paper, and everybody got excited about it. And it was a lot of fun. One of the things that one did as an Army wife of an officer, because he was an officer, was to visit the colonel's wife. You have your card, and you go and you make a formal call. So you get all dressed up in the middle of the desert, which is where El Paso is, and you go and make a formal call on the colonel's wife. That was me. And it was supposed to last 20 minutes, and you make chit-chat for a while, and then you shake hands very politely and thank her for allowing me to come and sit in her tea parlor. Anyway, I went and visited the colonel's wife. She had not been to the fencing meet, and all of this was new stuff to her. So 2 hours later, she allowed me to leave because she was fascinated. Here, she was stuck in El Paso, too, you understand, even though she was a colonel's wife. So this was a little vignette of what fencing could do for people as a, I won't say recreation, but as a method for people to get together and have some fun. Now, where are we? Oh, hey, he's home from the war in 1962, 63. When did you come home? 53. He was only in Korea for 9 months. Okay. And he came home, and we started the fencing. You know, he got a job, and I started working for the Fencing Association in my living room. I think we had a three-room apartment, yes. In my living room, I had the files and the typewriter and my skills and so forth. And this went on for several years. By 1968, the fencing organization had grown to maybe 800-900 members by then. And all the work was done by hand, no computers, no nothing. So we went to Mexico for the Olympics. Bill was the manager, and I was allowed to go along as wife because they always respect wife in these organizations, but they have a special category. So I had a D pass, and he had a major pass. And they found organized housing arrangements, and you know, I was handmaiden from the airplane to this, that, and the other thing. And I wound up living in an outpost from the main housing place with newspaper reporters from all over the world and many of the people who were referees for many sports. And I became friendly with the people from India who were there as referees for field hockey, which was lucky because the field hockey venue and the fencing venue were right next to each other in the Olympic sports compound. So for 2 weeks, I had Indian. Now, the Indians were of many distinctions. There was a Scotchman. There were a couple of Englishmen. There were a couple of Indians too. But the whole amalgamation of Indian, as is in the United States, if you come here and you become an American, no matter where you come from, what color you are, what shape you are, you're an American. These guys treated themselves the same way, which was revealing to me because you don't hear too much about the internal feelings among the people that you read about, you know, a big label, Indians. But the Indian, the Scotchman, was adorable. He was about 6'2" and charming. And the Brits were cute. And the Indians, one of the Indians was a very soigné, highly educated, cultivated, gentleman-type person. And we ate breakfast together, all of us. And one of them said to me one day, "I don't understand you," he said to me. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're an American and you drink tea for breakfast." Well, I drink tea for breakfast. My father was English Scotch and he taught me to drink tea for breakfast. So the whole world is meshed in many ways, what you eat, how you wear your clothes, what accent you use to speak. And it's a very interesting experience when you're put in a puddle of people like this. One morning I went out and there was a woman dressed in the most magnificent sari. You know what that is?
Yes.
Okay. And she was, this was really luxurious fabric because I'm a sewer and a dressmaker and a designer and so forth. Anyway, she was exquisite. And then if you read go down the costume, there she was with her Adidas shoes on her feet. Okay?
Yeah, that's an interesting picture.
Yes, it is. And she was proud of those shoes because her feet did not walk in those thin sandals where I don't know if you ever walked on a beach or with the sandals and the sand shifts through your feet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, in Mexico, it wasn't sand, it was pebbles. Mm-hmm. So she had Adidas shoes. And she was really happy. Beautiful. I mean, these women, the women that came along with the troops were highly educated, sophisticated, upper caste women who were absolutely lovely to talk to be with. And it was a very enjoyable experience because I was used to New York and used to the melting pot here. And where are we now? We're up to 1968. Okay. They had a meeting of all the English-speaking mission heads of missions, coaches, all the wheels at the competition. They had a big meeting, you know, the FIE and so forth. And at the end of it was announced that anybody who spoke English should get together and we would all have lunch together. So here's this motley English-speaking crew, Japanese people, Chinese people, Australians, New Zealanders, Brits. I think there was a Swiss guy. I don't know. Anybody who spoke English, we all had lunch together. And it was magnificent fun. And the guy from Australia, he said, "Oh, I'm looking forward to going after the competition. I'm going to New York to the headquarters of the United States Fencing Association." I said, "Oh dear, that's my living room." Then he said to me, "You too." So these sports, before there was big Olympic money available, were all shoestring events. They lived on their dues, and anybody who could scrape up a free gymnasium to run a competition. People didn't make contributions too much, but sometimes the manufacturers would cast a few useless sabers or somebody at somebody. But there was no money in it. And I always said, until there's money in fencing, it'll stay pure, it'll stay sportsmanlike, it'll stay quote and unquote. Well, I don't know, should I say this? Anyway, you get the message.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no money. It was all hand-to-mouth organization. And the kids out of college were, you know, sometimes they had their equipment from college and sometimes, anyway, we were all homemade and very happy doing it. Where are we now? 1968. Okay, 1968 was interesting for me personally because I helped organize a team. I knew all the kids. And by then, I think the office had moved to Colorado Springs. No, it was still, But I got friendly with somebody in the Olympic Committee, and I said to her, I'm going to Mexico with the team, and I would like to know what kind of costume is being offered to the athletes so that I can dress appropriately. Oh, blah, 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 blah. I said, well, look, I sew, you let me know where the material come from, I get in touch with them, and maybe they'll send me some yardage, I bought yardage, and I made skirts, jackets, pants. I've been sewing all my life. So anyway, I made myself comparable costume. It was green pants or green skirts and tan jackets, and I bought a couple of T-shirts, which turned out to be a good thing because they were using turtleneck shirts as part of the official costume. So I sewed my patch on my arm, and I looked like part of the gang, and off I went. How much more do you want?
It's as much as you can tell me about your experiences there.
Okay. I think one of the questions was atmosphere and people speaking to each other. Mm-hmm. Well, during the course of the competitions, as you are aware, the two young black people made their public demonstration. And there was a lot of consternation. And some of the kids went to lunch with us one day, and they were, you know, they were young, and they were socially inclined, and they were all for solidarity and everybody being, I don't want to be too, they were distressed that there was a movement to curtail this kind of activity because it did not redound too well internationally. And I said to them, well, consider, you guys are Jewish, and you have your Shabbos, and you have your bar mitzvahs and stuff. Is it appropriate to interject this sort of thing in a place that's inappropriate? So they could see that there are places where you do this sort of thing and places where you don't achieve your desired effect because you get more people mad at you than want to help you. That was one thing. And then during the course of the week that this happened, people were talking and there was rumble. And then something happened that everybody grouped together and everybody had an opinion and it glorified the world. And it was this. Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy married Onassis. And this became a solidifying world conversation focus, and everybody had an opinion. I mean, all the guys, all the women, everybody had an opinion about Jackie marrying Onassis. Hmm. Now, you asked me about atmosphere. This will create, this had almost the same effect, although not as sad, as when Princess Diana was killed. Everybody has a feeling and an opinion, and we all had a stake in Jackie because, you know, Kennedy was part of the history of the United States by this time. And it was still recent enough so that people had a personal feeling about, oh, where were you the day Kennedy was killed? And, you know, it was only 5 years later. So Jackie was still public property. And Jackie married Onassis, and everybody had something to talk about.
Interesting. And that happened the same week as the protest?
That happened about 3 days after Carlos shook his fist.
Oh, how interesting. I've had a couple other people tell me that they were approached by reporters after the protest on the medal stand, and they thought the reporters were going to ask them what they thought about the protest, but instead they were asked what they thought about Jackie marrying Onassis.
Oh yeah, it took front and center, absolutely.
That's interesting.
Well, you know, you can only say so much about people who have problems of life-threatening importance, and either you want to get involved or you stay out of the way, but everybody essentially sympathizes with people who are being mistreated, but not everybody has a desire to go on the battlefield or go in the front lines. Mm-hmm. So tacitly, possibly everybody was in agreement. I have no idea, but possibly everybody was in agreement that the blacks needed to be treated better and given more opportunities and so forth. But not everybody wanted to get on the battlefield for that cause. Mm-hmm. And there was no lynching. There was no follow-up rioting. There was no attempt to physically abuse any of the other black athletes. In fact, the Carlos people were gotten out of the way fast. But there was a fair representation of black athletes. And I think Bill told you about the happiest scene that one could imagine when Beeman did his jump and he got his gold medal. Mm-hmm. And I have never seen anybody as purely happy as that young man. He was about 6 foot something and black as ink, but sweet, and he walked around like he was 7 feet off the ground. Mm-hmm. And if you can imagine happiness, this was happiness. In my whole life, I've never seen anybody that happy.
Oh. Well, do you remember anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights, hearing about it in the months leading up to the games and about, you know, what their specific goals as an organization were?
Probably not. Mm-hmm. As a person who was involved in running the fencing organization, raising two babies, getting the Olympic team ready to go, getting my husband through school. He was still going to school in those days. He came back from the war. He had to get himself a master's degree, and then he started working on his PhD. And I don't live in the black neighborhood, and I'm not involved with black people. I don't go to church. So I have never had a contact with any of the people who have, you know, other problems. While I was getting ready to go to Mexico, however, the news from Mexico was bad. Mm-hmm. Because the students down there were rioting, and there were, you know, shooting incidents. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of unrest in Mexico. And I was not particularly interested in going where there was going to be shooting. I have two children. My husband had come home from the war. I had enough shooting. He had been able to escape from Nazi Germany. So, you know, I wasn't looking for more revolutions. I didn't need any of that. Mm-hmm. But by the time the Olympics team left, the Mexicans assured everybody that there would be no shooting. Now, shooting is forever. You know, a bullet in your heart, you don't come back. Mm. So I will tell you right now that if I see anybody with a gun, I leave rapidly. Mm. And you may laugh, but when I was invited to come to the Olympics in 1972 as a day guest, I got off the plane in Munich, and what do we see surrounding the airport? But guys with big rifles. Because that was the day that the Palestinians invaded the Olympic Village and took hostages. But this is after the 1968 Olympics. So my feeling about Olympics is not really peace and love. My feeling about the Olympics is keep your head down. If you watched any of the preparations in London for the 2012 Olympics, mm-hmm. they had a whole business before the games about how many people were hired for security and the soldiers were hired for security. But the Brits are smart. They advertised in advance that they weren't going to take anybody's nonsense. And that was a nice, smooth, calm, peaceful Olympics.
Yes, that's true. Well, what were your impressions of the security measures in Mexico City at the time?
We had been assured we'd be safe. Mm-hmm. So when we went out to go to the opening ceremony, there were busloads of soldiers all around the compound with their guns.
And how did you feel about that?
Well, I'm an American, and that's kind of a shield to me, too. And, of course, there were several thousand other people there. Mm-hmm. And you don't know which ones are plainclothesmen, and you don't know which ones are in uniform. But we had been assured that we were safe. Mm-hmm. By then, I knew quite a few of the Mexican fencing people because they used to come to New York for fencing competitions. And we got to know them, and some of them were in the army in Mexico. And They were highly placed politically, and they came from wealthy families, which in the United States has one flavor, but in a place like Mexico has a totally different flavor. Being wealthy puts you in a category where you become untouchable. And these were the people we knew. So we were really more or less sure that we'd be okay. Mm-hmm. There was a thing on your paper about relations with the Soviets.
Yes, I will get to that, or you can talk about it right now.
Well, it's all people-to-people kind of stuff. The year before the Olympics, 1967, there was a world championship of fencing in Montreal, Canada, in conjunction with Expo 67. How old are you?
I'm 37.
Okay, so you have some living memory. I always have to know what cohort people are so they I know what reference points they have.
Yeah.
Anyway, 1967 World Championships in Montreal, and all the nations came because Canada was not the arch enemy of Russia, so everybody came. And we all spaced our little groups around the edge of the skating rink that they had dried out and made into a fencing venue. And there were Americans and Canadians and French and Armenians and Hungarians and whoever turned up. And there was one pod way across the gym from the United States of Russians. And nobody was allowed to go near them because, you know, they could not be contaminated by democracy. This is ganz verboten. So we had our children with us, and my son was almost six, cute as a button, smart as a whip, very inquisitive, very conversational, and he was the only one of the Americans who was allowed to go near the Russians. So here's my little six-year-old kid, Alex, going over to socialize with the Russians, and pretty soon he comes back with Russian candy and Russian pins, because this is always a big business in the sports, they trade pins, and Russian stickers for the labels and all kinds of junk. And the commissar, the police representative in the fencing, you know, in the fencing group with the Russians, was a woman doctor. And she had had to leave her children home because they were held hostage until she got back. I mean, this is really, you know, life is not pleasant. And the only American anybody was allowed to talk to was my little six-year-old kid. So every now and then, Alex would come back with whatever treasures they gave him, and how are you doing over there? Oh, yeah, they're very nice to me. They love me, blah, blah, blah. Go to 1968, a year later. Same group comes to Mexico. Same commissar, the doctor. And she wanted to know right away, how is Alex? Because she spoke English. So that was my contact personally with the Russian fencing team, 1967, 1968. And there were still some people who had been there in 67, and they knew Alex too. But Alex couldn't speak any Russian, they, you know. But he became their mascot, sort of their pet. So it puts a different face on Russian people who were there, not under protest, but very constrained. There were just no communication among them, mm-hmm. except for one thing. When you have a lot of international people, there's always talk about trading this, that, and the other thing. And one of the most convenient things to trade is coins. So there was a perfectly legitimate, no black market, no nothing, trading in American and whatever foreign coins. I have a large collection of foreign coins. And the Russians were very adamant. No, we will trade a ruble for the equivalent in American money, and we want Kennedy dollars. So we didn't go to Mexico prepared with Kennedy dollars. So one of the men lived in Texas, and somehow or other the message got conveyed to this man in Texas. When you come to Mexico City, bring a bunch of Kennedy dollars so we can trade rubles. So I traded a ruble for a dollar and 10, no, they wanted exact trade, 10 cents, for a Russian ruble, which was very interesting because you could see the Cyrillic writing and the pictures and all the other stuff. And that was my personal, interaction with the Russians. Yes. I had nothing to do with the fencing. I had nothing to do with politics.
Well, what were your impressions of Mexico City and its people when you first arrived? And did you have any interactions? And did you go sightseeing?
Well, we all went sightseeing more or less because as manager, Latsko got a car. And we had a lot of bravado people. So whenever we had time off, did we have to pay for the gas or did the Olympic Committee pay for the gas? No, we had to pay for our own gas, but they gave us a car. So we went to the downtown part of Mexico City, the Zocalo, and the car did not like to go there because altitude is very peculiar in Mexico City. But we did the Anthropology Museum and we did the public parks. And then we went to a place called Taxco, which is a silver city, and we bought jewelry. And we didn't roam too far because the fencing schedule was pretty full. You know, there was activity almost every day. But we had a lot of fun and everybody was most cordial to us. And after a few days of bonjour, no wait, that's French, of buenos dias, you sort of get used to being in a foreign environment. Mm-hmm. And it's not very difficult. And I speak some French and I learned some Spanish and, you know, you make do. And of course, we all had badges on. We were definitely Americans. We were not masquerading as anything else. And when you go traveling, from our experience, you stay Americans. Don't try to hide it. Mm. If they don't like you, they don't have to talk to you. Mm. Anyway, yes, Mexico itself was an interesting place. Mm-hmm. Having come from New York City, big cities don't frighten me. Mm-hmm. But there were people who'd never seen a mountain before, who'd never seen a foreign person before. I mean, you know, you have to understand that a lot of the kids come from the Midwest. And it's very provincial in the Midwest. One of my grandchildren went to school in Illinois, and one of the class projects was to take a trip to Japan. But she'd been to Europe by this time and other places. But some of the kids had never been out of Illinois, and when they got to Tokyo, they were panicked. But big cities are, you know, I can navigate in big cities, no problem. Mm-hmm. So you just you just change the signage on the boards, and away you go.
Right.
So that's my impression of Mexico City. I've been back there since. Have we been back there since? Yeah, yeah. The mercados and the shopping, and I still have some of the stuff I bought. Mm-hmm. And when I got home, my son was by now in 7th grade, 8th grade, I don't know, at anybody's school. Mrs. Latsko, would you make us a lecture about your trip to Mexico? So I gathered up the slides and I took some of the stuff with me to school and I gave them a lecture about Mexico. And I said, Mexico is a very difficult place to live because it's got a lot of mountains in it and not much water. And the kids had been studying geography, so they understood that you need water to grow crops. And mountains are hard to live in. And it was interesting for the kids. And, you know, the ooh and ah when I showed them what I'd bought. But generally, that was my personal experiences of Mexico. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time with the team because I'm the team mother, feeding them, washing their clothes. And they had a battery of cold water washing machines. But I managed, you know, took the bag of laundry and I brought it back clean. And we all ate together in the communal dining room, which was built on top of a Mexican temple, which they found when they were doing archaeology excavation. So that was an interesting adventure. And then I think he mentioned that this particular family who had been very, they were so nice to us. And the only thing we could do for them was let them come and have dinner at the dining room, which was absolutely restricted, off limits to everybody who was not involved in the Olympics. So this was a major breakthrough for these people, a coup.
Mm. Well, what did you think of the accommodations and of the Olympic Village itself?
I did not live in the Olympic Village. I was restricted to it. I was not part of the team. This is very clear designation or demarcation. Either you are part of the team or you are everybody else. Mm. So they had this housing facility for reporters and referees and camp followers, which I considered myself. And it was a beautiful accommodation out way 20-minute bus ride away from the main venue. And we got a look riding through the barrios of the conditions of poor people in Mexico. And one of the Indians, when we were riding through the barrio, said to me, "This is luxury compared to India." And I said to myself, "Good heavens." But you can't encompass these things unless you see them. And of course, if you've seen pictures of India, you know that this sort of thing is what, you know, what is afflicted on people who live in those conditions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's not pretty. But we live a privileged life in the United States, and we know it. That's mm-hmm. why it's very important that everybody should vote next month. As I preach to people, democracy is not a spectator sport. And if you don't vote, you have no right to complain. But that's another side. Mm-hmm. I take being an American very seriously.
I think we should, definitely. Well, what are your memories of the opening ceremony? So did you get to watch the opening ceremony?
Oh, it was fabulous. Totally fantastic. I had a brand new camera, and I used it with great glee. It was wonderful. I think that was my first opening ceremony. Yes, and I was awed by it. I don't think we had a television then, so I'd never seen it before. The spectacle was phenomenal. Of course, if you have New York and the Radio City Music Hall and stuff, you see spectacle, but this was really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And the intent of the Mexicans to do it perfectly was appreciated by everybody because Mexico had a perceived self, you know, xenophobic image of themselves, La Mañana. But they stuck to their guns. They got it going at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was beautiful. Beautiful day. Everybody was in costume. Comes the Czech parade. They were done in pink. And the whole place went wild, because they'd just been overrun by the Russians. And, of course, that was international solidarity for these poor guys who'd been put in in subjection, if you will, subjugation. So that was my impression of the opening ceremony, up to and including the pigeons. And I was very amused to watch one of the black athletes from Africa run out and catch a pigeon. I'd never seen anybody catch a bird by hand before.
And then what did he do with it?
He stuffed it in his shirt. We figured he was going to go take it back and roast it. Who knows?
That's interesting.
By that time, euphoria took over and everybody was screaming and yelling. And it was daylight. It wasn't nighttime, so no fireworks, but the pigeons went up. I'm not sure they even had balloons because, you know, the quantity of money available in 1968 is not what it is today. And, of course, electronic technology changes a lot of stuff, too. Mm. You know, it's kind of hard to put yourself back into the atmosphere 44 years ago.
I'm sure.
Right.
I find it hard to put myself back in the atmosphere of yesterday, so 44 years ago has got to be really challenging.
Yeah, well, it's they become the high points in your lives. I am on the I keep telling myself, do it. I have to write to Ralph Lauren and tell him how beautifully he outfitted the team and how much I personally appreciated what he did for the team, because they looked splendid, they conducted themselves with dignity, and he didn't put a hat with a brim on it so the stupid kids could turn it around backwards. That was something I noticed. But I had been outfitting teams for quite a few years. I mean, physically, I went and bought the clothes and sewed the patches on and made sure the right size got on the right kid. So I'm aware of how much is involved in putting clothes on a team for public display. I really must write to the man. He did magnificently.
I'm sure he would appreciate that, definitely.
I'm sure he will. It's just a question of inertia.
Well, describe like what you were doing during the actual fencing competition while the U.S. team was competing in the fencing competition.
The fencing venue was a big open space with sheds. I think it was covered over. It was a big auditorium type place. And all around it were little booths where each team had a place to make camp. you know, with your equipment and your trainer with the water bottles and the bandages. And everybody has to be there, but not everybody's fencing all the time. So there has to be a place to sit and wait your turn and commiserate afterwards and so forth. So I spent a great deal of my time there because I was there with the fencing team and Bill was there with the fencing team. And when they brought the lunches in, I helped distribute the lunches and I made sure that the score sheets got, you know, taken care of properly. No, I was, you know, assistant manager, you might say, unofficially. But I'd been around fencing how many years by then? So, you know what you have to do when you do it. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I had to write to my children all the time. So I'd go around every day. I need a joke for my letter to my kids. And one by they obligingly told me little jokes that I could write to my children. Because I left two children home, one 6 or 7 and one 12 or 13, I forget. Anyway, they were at home with a keeper.
Mm-hmm. Well, gender verification testing was first implemented in 1968. Were you aware of this test, and did it affect any of the athletes that you knew, or did anybody talk about it at the time?
They probably did, but as I said, I was not a member of the team.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a iron curtain between the team and everybody else. And there were some things that were not presented publicly.
Mm-hmm.
I heard later on that one of the ladies was accosted and she screamed like bloody fierce, "How dare you? I have 3 grandchildren. Of course I'm a female." But... There were was that the beginning of the drug testing too?
Yeah,
that was the beginning of the drug testing too. And I was enlisted to supervise collecting urine and stuff like that. But you know, you do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you feel about it at the time, or what did you think about it at the time?
What, drug testing or sex testing?
Both, but since you were involved in having to help with collecting urine samples.
I was very, very adamantly in favor of keeping the children as clean and free from drugs as possible.
Mm-hmm.
100% no drugs. Absolutely. No way, no good. Mm-hmm. And no American tested positive.
Mm-hmm. So you talked before about interactions with the Soviet athletes. Do you remember that in 68 was the first time that an official team from East Germany competed? And did you have any experiences or memories with any East German team members?
No, we were more concerned with the Russians because they had their little booth next to ours and we'd had experience with them in 67 and we found them very agreeable, very, you know, they did their job and they knew that if they lost, they would lose their apartments in Moscow and so forth. But aside from the possibility, no, there was no inclination at the moment that there was fear of anybody defecting. This was not in the air. It was much more in the air in 84 when they didn't come. Because they didn't come because Mr. Carter said no, blah, blah, blah. But that was where the concern was. In Mexico, where do you defect to? Poof. But if you're in the United States, that's a different story. But that didn't happen in 68 because where do you defect to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, practicality is thus. In those days... most of the kids were not bilingual or trilingual. It was still, we're coming out of the poor, insulated life many people lived. And internationalism was not as broad a spectrum as it is now. But don't forget, we got the internet now, and we got Twitter and all that other junk that makes the whole world 5 cents away from each other.
Right.
But in 1968... okay, so where would you defect to?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't speak Spanish and you're not brown, they know you right away. Of course, the Mexicans are not white. They are brown.
Mm-hmm.
Mexicans are Indians.
Well,
and there's a thin layer of white people in power, but even the people in power were brown. The guys we knew, the fences, Colonel, what's his name? They were brown. They weren't white. I mean, they stick out in that population. But in the United States in 84, this is a different story.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't come.
Well, what are some other just memorable experiences that you recall from the 68 games?
From the 68 games, well, I had a lot of fun learning how you test a weapon on a field hockey team. My son, at the age of 2, was brought into the fencing world as a technician. Here's a 2-year-old kid with a soldering iron fixing strips. I don't know if you've ever seen a fencing competition, but it was done in those days on copper mesh to complete the circuit for the scoring machines. And if you have a hole in the copper mesh, it has to be fixed. And how do you fix it? You solder it together. And they gave Alex a soldering iron when he was 2, and they showed him how to fix copper strip. So I had a lot of experience with the technical part of fencing and, of course, keeping my kid from killing himself. So when I got to watch a hockey game, I was highly amused when they did weapons testing to make sure the weapon was okay. Now, there's no moving parts to a hockey stick. You understand this.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was take a ring and run it down the stick. And if it didn't get stuck or it was too loose, I don't know what the classifications were. But here the guy lines everybody up in a row in the team, and he goes along, hockey sticks, present hockey sticks, and hold it out and let the ring go up and down on it, and they were testing weapons. I thought that was hysterical, because when you have to test electronic equipment, it's very complicated with wires and machinery and stuff. So that was one of my little side amusements at the Olympics. They wouldn't let me near the boating because I guess they were afraid people would fall in unexpectedly.
Mm.
But I had a badge that would allow me to go any place.
Oh.
Of course, I had a Type D badge, and the hangers-on, the wives, were more or less, you know, we were what?
Just referees.
We were sort of invisible and visible. You know, as long as you stayed out of trouble, you could do almost anything you want. And I did. I wandered around. But the distance was huge. I didn't speak Spanish, and I had no transportation.
Mm.
So comes the nighttime when I had to go back to my digs in the hinterland where the reporters and the judges were living. I had to get a bus. Now, all the buses were color-coded. They were red. They were yellow buses, school buses, and they all had a color coding for various parts of the Olympic Village. And at night, you can't tell what color they are.
Oh.
So I got on the wrong bus. And the driver's screaming at me, the athletes are screaming at me in various languages. I don't know how I finally got salvaged, but anyway, I never tried to catch a bus at night again because I couldn't tell what bus they were. Well, we managed. I can scream with the best of them when I have to. And if you're a fencing coach, which I had been doing for quite a few years by then, you learn how.
Well, did you see the closing ceremony?
No.
Mm.
1968. Latsko was employed by a company, and it sent him to a business trip, which did not allow us to stay in Mexico City.
Oh.
So we came home, and I didn't have a television in those days, so I've never seen a closing ceremony.
Oh.
I've been to openings, but never closings. So he went off to his business trip, and I came home and my children. And there's a little postscript to the business trip after the 1968 Olympics. He had to go around the world, and he called me from Japan toward the end of the business trip. And I said to him, "Don't come home." And, of course, that's a traffic stopper right away. And then I said to him, "Come to Las Vegas," because my brother lived in Las Vegas, and it was Thanksgiving time, and we had made it up that we'd all meet in Las Vegas and have Thanksgiving dinner with my brother. But that was the next chapter of 1968. We had a lot of adventures all the time in our lives.
Sounds like it, definitely.
Yep.
Well, Tell me about how you think your experiences in the 68 games and with the fencing team in 68, how that affected your life or the path of your life overall.
Oh, it got better.
And how so?
Well, we got more involved with fencing. The children got bigger. We got more money to travel. And we went to, his next round was the 1972 Olympics, where he was manager again. And by that time, I was a little bit more freer. So I said, I'm not staying in New York while you're going roaming in wherever. And I packed my two kids up, and we went to England for 2 weeks on a bus trip all around England. Then we went to Holland for a week while we waited for him in Munich. And he called me from Munich in Holland, and he said, well, we have a day off on Tuesday. Why don't you come down? So we hopped on a plane, and we went down to Munich. And that was the day that the assault on a team was made by the Palestinians. So we were there that exact day. And I have pictures that I took of the helicopters coming in with the police and stuff. But you asked me how it was. It only got better. And it's been going like this for the next 40 years.
Well,
my life is fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds like it, definitely. Well, Connie, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Say again?
What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Today's Olympic hopeful in fencing. Really nothing specific, because the character of the people involved is as important as what they do. And it's like every piece of educational opportunity. If you work hard and you need luck, things go your way. But I'm sure your life indicates the same thing. I mean, you have a lot of time to ruminate when you're in a fencing meet for 14 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You get to be very good conversationalist, and everybody knows everybody else thoroughly. I did a major amount of embroidery sitting at competitions, which is hung on my walls. And one day, one of the kids said to me, what the heck are you doing? So I took out the, I don't know if you've ever embroidered using a chart with the colors and the design.
Mm-hmm.
So I took out the blueprint, and I said, here, this is what I'm doing, and this is what it'll turn out to be. And suddenly, there's another dimension to Connie. She's not just wasting time and being a dope. Here's a blueprint, and here's the color chart, and you have to convert it to stitches on a piece of fabric. And the same thing happened when I took a mechanical drawing class somewhat after that. And the guy, girl in the class, what do I need her for? Go away, don't bother me. But anyway, I said to myself, So I took a dress pattern to school one day, and of course it's a blueprint. I don't know, do you sew?
Yes.
It's a blueprint, and it shows you how to do your layout for cutting and how you make the garment and so forth. Wow, this was a whole dimension. He had never seen a dress pattern before, which, if you're a mechanical arts teacher, you really should know about various kinds of designs and blueprints and how you build stuff. After that, it was a little easier being the only girl in this mechanical drawing class. But as I say, I've had an interesting life, and it keeps on going.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
you may ask me one more question, and then my throat is given out.
Okay. So my last question really was just if there was anything else that you would like to tell us about for the recording, for the record.
Well, I think I gave you all the publicly approvable stories. My favorite one for myself, well, two. The lady with the Adidas on her shari, the shari and the Adidas. That was such a beautiful scene. Absolutely gorgeous. And then everybody's running around the compound yelling Ohio, because that's how you say hello in Japanese in the morning. So Ohio, and then here's the Indian lady with her shari and her Adidas shoes. And then the fact that I had enough skill and perseverance to get the fabric and make the clothes. It made me fit right in with the rest of the team. And Even the Mexican colonel with whom I was quite friendly at the time saw me in this costume. He admired it because he knew it was an issue. I said, no, I made it. These are my personal, because I'm interested in textile and design and stuff like that. Okay?
Wonderful.
I'm strictly a female. You have to understand that. I'm not a masculine person at all.
Well, it's great to get a different perspective.
And a non-athletic perspective, even though I had been teaching fencing and so forth.
Definitely.
But team-wise, either you're on the team or you're dead meat. Which is good, because it gives the Olympic movement total control over whom they have engaged to represent the United States. And I'm sure you heard that Jan Romery carried the flag.
Yes.
Oh, beg pardon?
Yes. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. She was very excited, but very nervous. So I spent a half an hour talking to her, and I told her, hey, big boom for girls. Give it a whirl. Because she was the first female to carry a flag. And she was a magnificent woman, beautiful girl, absolutely gorgeous and bright. And she carried it off with absolute poise and aplomb. And we were all proud of us because, you know, we were all cheering for her. Now, I have a little mystical business in my life, which is very unexplainable, but things happen. And one day, I was in the technical room where they did the weapons checking and stuff, and I said to the head technician, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
I said to the head technician, I'd love to have a pin like you're wearing, because he had a really nice oval-shaped pin with some very pretty engraving on it. He said, oh, no, you can't have that. Why? Because most people were falling all over me. And I said, why? He said, well, that's a special pin that only the Mexican Olympic team has. Nobody gets it other than the Mexican athletes. I said, well, how did you get it? He said, well, I did them a lot of favors, and I fixed their weapons and blah, blah, blah. So I said to him, well, okay, I'll make a deal with you. You tell me anything you want, and if I get it, you give me the pin. So he thought back in his head and he said, okay, here's one for you. You get me a pair of tickets. He's telling me, you get me a pair of tickets to tonight's competition so my friends can come to the fencing meet. I will give you the pin. So I said, okay, fair enough. I had been spending some time in the American Olympic Committee office because I knew those guys too. And it was a place to hang out sometimes. And I had the reception desk. So I was sitting there at the reception desk, and people are putting stuff there and taking away and yak, yak, yak. And it comes about 5 o'clock. I looked at what was left on the desk, and lo and behold, there was a pair of tickets to that night's competition that somebody had just put there. Apparently nobody needed it, so they just put it there. I said to myself, hoo-hoo. So I took the tickets, and I ran looking for the guy with the pin I wanted. And I said, Dan, I got your tickets. And he looked at me like I had 4 heads. How did you do that? I didn't tell him, but I got the pin, which I still wear on my jacket. Now, what's the explanation for that? I have no idea.
How interesting.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you send a wish up and it comes back.
Yeah, definitely. Well.
Yeah, well, as I say, I've had an interesting life.
definitely sounds like it. Well, Connie, I'm going to go ahead and turn the recorder off unless there's anything else you want to get recorded.
I don't know. I think nothing there has to be censored. It's been all pretty nice and sweet.
Okay.